Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church and for those that are disillusioned. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz, and check out our Facebook page, Off Grid Christianity. We have our own website now, offgridchristianity.co.uk. So please enjoy today's guest, who worked for both the BBC and LWT, that's London Weekend Television, before moving to Norwich. Our guest has travelled throughout the UK and abroad on behalf of New Frontiers and is still involved in leadership training. Now, 4 years ago, his daughter Ali died of breast cancer, leaving a three-year-old, a five-year-old and a husband. And the loss of Ali helped him write his latest book, Hope Wins, How a Vision of Our Eternal Future Impacts Our Lives Today, available at all good Christian bookshops. So, why did our guest give up his career in TV media? What did he do when at the Beeb and LWT? Why did he move to Norwich? How did he cope when given the news he had prostate cancer? And how do you grieve, especially when it is your daughter you had to bury? Can you blame God? Did he blame God? Why did he write the book? And how cathartic was the process? And why did he go to China? All these questions, including how he makes bread, no doubt. Better find out the answers as I welcome today's guest to Off Grid Christianity, and that is Gough Hope. Gough, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Sir, thank you also for being so understanding with regard to all our technical problems.
No problem, Martin. It's a joy to be here. It's been great getting to know you a little bit this last little while.
A month ago, when we were trying to put this together for the podcast, and I wish I'd recorded it now because that phone call we had was just brilliant. So yep. Thank you very much indeed for that. So let's go for it then. Question number one. If you could interview somebody over an evening meal, who would you like to meet?
Well, this might be a bit of a surprise, but I think I'd chance an evening with Jose Mourinho. I'm a Chelsea fan, lifelong supporter, okay? I saw Jake Humphries do an interview at the end of season 1 year. I think he might have been in Jose's home, and he was such a friendly, at-ease guy, you know. And, of course, we know the special one and so on and how he's not always quite like that. And I would want to ask him about that moment in the 2015 season at Chelsea. It was during his second coming there at Stamford Bridge when Premier League champions the year before, all going quite well. It was really great. And then in this game on a winter evening, one of the Chelsea players went down with an injury and the Chelsea medic ran across to attend. And I don't know, you may remember this, Jose, bless him, he sprinted over and gave this dear medic an absolute earful, kind of humiliated her. Basically, she ended up leaving the club. He lost the dressing room. And within a couple of months, he lost his job. And I just want to say, Jose, why do you do it? Why couldn't you find it anywhere in you to say, ooh, I blew it there? It was a tragedy. It was going so, so well. And then it all went wrong. Bit of a shame. So I'd want to sort of ask him about that and can we see the nice guy now and again? That might just help.
That's a great answer. Well, let me know how you get on and just ask him as well if he'd ever thought of managing my team, Bristol City. Let me know what he says. Question two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please?
Okay, well, I'm going to go for character and I'm going to cheat a bit. I started off thinking of Peter because I've just started watching The Chosen and he comes across quite a rough sort of character, down to earth. But then, no, let's move on. Then I thought of Job, good old Job, because his world fell apart and he just hung on to God and he had very robust conversations with God. But bless him, he just held on in there. But in the end, I chose Caleb, okay? And the reason I chose Caleb, the whole subject of hope is a big deal with me. There they are, God's people on the edge of the promised land, and they go and check it out and they come back. Yay, it's flowing with milk and honey. And he brought a big, great big bundle, a load of grapes back with them. And so Caleb said, yay, let's go for it. And everyone else starts saying, oh, I don't know, you know, it might be a bit tricky. We might be late home for tea. It might not work. Boom, boom, boom. And so it all got called off. They stayed in a desert old place when they could have had something better because they were afraid of the future. And then, of course, years later, when he finally got his chance, those classic words, give me this mountain. As an old guy, give me this. Well, that's great, isn't it? It's keeping that sense of hope and passion into your latter years. I want to be like that. So Caleb would be my choice.
That's a great answer. Do you know, I don't think we've ever had Caleb being chosen before.
Ah, well, there you go.
So well done. Yeah, excellent. Thank you very much indeed. Question three. This is going to be interesting. If you were Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, I'm going to go for a fact that you're going to go for a frivolous answer here. What would it be?
I would want to make it the law one day a week. Either the whole of social media shuts down or you can only say nice things. You know, or, I mean, you could even call it Sabbath. I don't know. But, you know, one way or another, to put something in place that shields our children and our grandchildren from all the grotty stuff that's swirling around out there. So there you go. That's what I would try and do.
Do you know what? That is going through. Forget frivolous answers. That is the number one answer. Oh. Thank you. I'd ban it completely, me. I want to go back to the 1700s. No, I don't. But we were doing well in the 1990s until it all of a sudden exploded.
It's scary, isn't it? It's quite scary.
It can be, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's good things about it and there's bad things about it.
Mm-hmm.
But yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Good.
Good answer. Outside of family events, question four, Young Goff. What has been your most enjoyable day out to date, please?
Well, you made it tricky by saying not to do with family. So
yeah.
I'm going back to 1966, and you may well know what happened in 1966.
July the 30th?
Yeah. I was a schoolboy in London, and I was about, I don't know, was it 13, something like that. And this word came around a bit earlier that year. There's going to be, in the opening ceremony, they wanted some local schoolboys to be dressed up in the kit of the different nations taking part. If you were interested, put your name forward. So I put my name.
Wow.
Yeah. I put my name forward and I got in. And I was signed up for Portugal, okay?
Ooh.
So I got a complete Portugal kit, complete with Adidas boots, which we all got to keep the whole lot afterwards. And in the opening ceremony, we walked around that hallowed turf, and it was such fun. And then we stayed to watch the opening match, which was England Uruguay. I think it might have been nil all, but who cares? It was a beautiful
thing. Apparently,
it was a bit, but it was just being there, sitting in my Portugal kit, a bit special.
Have you still got it?
Do you know what? What an idiot! I haven't. Why on earth didn't I keep that? It would be quite special, wouldn't it?
Yeah. What did you do with it?
Oh,
then?
I don't know. I grew out of it, and maybe gave it away, silly chap.
That's a great answer. Enjoyable day out, going to the first game at Wembley.
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to walk across a pitch, or were you banned from it?
No, I think we were kind of on the edge of behind the goals, that sort of thing. I don't think we got actually under the pitch itself. But it was pretty special. Whoa, you know, it was nice.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
That is brilliant.
Yeah.
A really good friend of mine who's Scottish. His birthday is July the 30th. He doesn't like me on that day for some reason. No, I can't remember why. Yeah. Question five. What has been your most embarrassing moment, please, Goff?
Well, there could be so many here. I'm going to pick one. Some years ago when my son Steve was about 10 years old, we were walking home one evening. It was kind of dusk. And I saw my friend's car pull outside our house. So I thought, he was a bit of a wag. So I thought, let's have some fun here. So I crept in the bushes and I sort of crept along, and I leapt out as he was getting out of his car and did a dramatic da-da, and it was a complete stranger.
Hey.
My son, he disowned me. He was so embarrassed. So that was pretty embarrassing. So there's a harmless one.
What happened as a result of it?
I just had to, I'm ever so sorry. I thought you were someone else, and tried to make up to my son to show him that I'm not a complete idiot all the time.
The person concerned, did he see it as a funny thing?
I think he sort of thought, strange people live around here, but I got away with it, I think.
A work colleague of mine, we went swimming one day, and as you do in swimming pools, you like to duck each other and everything else like that. And I was at the shallow end, having swum at least a length, and he was at the deep end, and I just got my head just above water, and you could see Rich swimming along. I'm thinking, no, he doesn't think that person in front of him is me, does he? And he obviously did, because you could just see this immense grin come up his face as he leaps out of the water and pushes the bloke down into water. And I sort of get up and wave to him. Yeah.
Keeps you humble, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, well, not for me that night. It didn't. No, I tell you. So, Goff, after all that, thank you very much indeed. So many questions to ask you. So little time which to do it. I did say you were in TV media. So tell us all about that, why you worked for the Beeb and then LWTV, London Weekend Television.
My dad was a vicar, okay, and the endless question used to be, are you going to follow in your father's footsteps? I thought, you know, I didn't say this, but, you know, not on your Nelly. I kind of wanted to go in the opposite direction. I wanted fun. It was a very exciting time in television. And so I thought, I know what, I'm going to apply to the BBC. And so I applied and I was accepted. And I got a dream job. I'm working at the White City, the studios there. Mm-hmm. I was working in television recording. So that's VT editing and all that stuff. And it was that heyday of, you know, they were making Monty Python Flying Circus. They were doing Top of the Pops, Match of the Day, big studio productions like War and Peace. And I'm working there, getting paid for it. It was very special. So that's kind of how I got there. Really just, I was attracted, I suppose, a bit by the excitement. I was a bit of an engineer, a bit into sort of techie stuff. So that was it as well. Yeah, I had a blast. That's how I got going. And I went on from there, really.
Right. So this is the $64,000 question. Are you to blame for recording over all the amazing tapes that have been lost?
Well, you know, that's the thing. Because video recording in those days, I mean, everything was so different to what it is now. A colour camera, you can put it in your back pocket.
Yeah.
Those days, it would fill a table. They were huge.
Yeah.
And like video recording machines were, they were the size of a wardrobe. They were huge. And the recording tape was 2 inches wide, if you can imagine it. And these great big spools. So we knew all about these great big spools. They took up all the space, and I can see how it happened. So, yeah, probably, you know, I was probably part of that craziness, you know. Right, we've got to get rid of some. It was tragic, you're right, you know. But we tried to transfer someone to film because that took up less space. But, it was a major problem way back in the day, yeah. Yeah.
So the next question is, how many of these tapes you've got in your attic?
Yeah. How do you know I'm in my attic? Yeah, I am. I'm up there in my office, my happy space up here. Yeah, if only. I don't think we realised at the time how privileged we were. I remember working on Match of the Day, and David Coleman was in the studio and all. My goodness. Yeah, it was a very special time. I don't know we totally appreciated it at the time, as you never quite do.
Yeah. And did you find Monty Python funny at the time?
Well, they were funny. Yeah. I mean, I think we were all sort of a bit, right, okay, I think I understand that. What's that? But they were funny guys. You know, they were just a bit unorthodox. And, you know, you'd go up to the bar and there they would be sort of just, they were different. You were very aware they were there, and they were clearly something a bit unusual and special. Yeah.
Well, that's great stuff. So why did you then leave Auntie to go to LWTV?
Well, I didn't go directly there. At the time I was at LWT, I stumbled across this church in London called Kensington Temple, which really, I mean, it really kind of opened my eyes, because like I was from a fairly traditional evangelical Church of England church, where my dad was a vicar in South London. And I went to Kensington Temple because I rather liked a girl who went there. And I just saw people who were not ashamed to be enjoying God and singing, praising, the friendship, the openness. Whoa, it really impacted me. And so that became a part of my regular life. And at that time, Lyndon Bowring was one of the pastors there, and he sort of took me under his wing. And I got involved leading a coffee bar outreach on the streets of Notting Hill Gate, and that was quite fun. It was a time when churches were doing coffee bar type. It was pretty fun. He'd get me to do a bit of, hey, why don't you speak and do, I mean, bless him, he really took chances with me, dear Lyndon. And it turned out, you know, I felt, okay, Lord, there's something going on here. I feel a stirring to speak and teach and encourage people about their faith, about knowing you. So he then suggested I go off to London Bible College, then LST. And do you know what? The night I proposed to my wife, Angie, it was the most unromantic thing ever, you know.
Tell me more.
Well, we're sitting in my car, and I think I had a BMW at the time. And I said, I really like you a lot. But and I just want to say, do you fancy coming on an adventure with me? I'm about to quit my job, and I'm going off to college to study theology. Will you come with me? Do you fancy an adventure? And amazingly, she said yes. So bless her, it was no, I mean, people got up in hot air balloons. They do all sorts of things. I ought to do it again, really, oughtn't I, properly.
Well, so you didn't even actually ask her to marry you. It's like, just go on an adventure.
Oh, yeah. I think I said, will you marry me as well in there somewhere. So that was how I then went off to to LST, London Bible College LST. And
yeah.
And to cut a long story short, after that, I then was back in LWT. I was working LWT and involved in local church. LWT, that was another fun time on the South Bank there. By this time, I'm like a project manager and doing stuff there, LWT. Yeah, that was fun. And then the call into sort of full-time thing, stuff, full-time ministry. We're kind of praying about the future. Like, I was juggling so many plates, young family, working in London, part of leadership in local church. And we've been praying about this, and this might be too long an answer, but it's a lovely thing, the way God sometimes works. We'd been praying one New Year's Eve, Lord, what's the way forward? I don't want to burn out. I want to do well as a dad and a church leader and so on. And a few weeks later, we happened to be having lunch in someone's home on a Saturday, and there was a guy there whose name was actually Henry Tyler, who was one of the founding sort of elders of New Frontiers. And this dear guy had just moved from Brighton, where Terry Virgo was.
Mm-hmm.
He just moved to Norwich at the age of 65 to a pretty busted little church. And our hearts sort of, we just clicked. And so dear Henry just looked at me and he said, why don't you come to Norwich and let's see what God will do? So we thought, okay, there was no offer of a job or anything. I commuted to London for a while. But do you know what? Looking back, I'm so glad I did. It was one of those things, you know, it's the Caleb thing, stepping out into an adventure, sensing that God's with you and just going for it. I'm eternally grateful. I've spent 37 years here in Norwich with the church here. I've been leading for over 30. And best adventure ever. So glad. So that led to the end of my TV days and the beginning of my church leadership full-time days up here in Norwich.
I want to ask about your dad, because he was an Anglican vicar, and you've gone to the more charismatic side. What did you think of that?
Bless him. He was very, very understanding. I mean, you may not remember, but back in the day, back in the 60s, evangelicalism in this country was pretty dry, pretty legalistic. You know, I remember someone wanted to bring a guitar into church. I mean, this was a lovely evangelical church, but you know, that's a bit worldly.
Yeah.
And from that point of view, I think he was open, but it was a difficult world to be free and really go for it, you know. And so at that time, your options were limited. And what was going on at Kensington Temple, I learned about the Holy Spirit, never even heard about the Holy Spirit before. And so he kind of understood and encouraged me and was good with it. He really was. I think he was a bit worried when I quit my BBC job. Whoa, what are you doing? But then any dad would, wouldn't you, really?
Yeah.
But bless him. No, he really, really got it, because they were the most exciting things in that period were the times when Billy Graham came over to the UK and took over Earl's Court, you know, arena.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was in all the news. This guy, this Christian guy who's just a bit different, and he doesn't wear any robes or anything, and he just, it's very clear. The Bible says this is, you know. So, yeah, that was the day.
Yeah.
And he was cool with it.
Oh, that's really good. Mm. Chatting to somebody else recently, he was thinking about, in his latter years, setting up a charity and doing this. That's what he wanted to do. And I was saying, well, you've got to take that first step and see what happens. And obviously, he's quite rightly, he was worried about finances and stuff. What would you say to people who today feel that they've got a calling, but it might mean moving 100 miles, 200 miles. It might mean giving up your job. What would you say to them?
Unreservedly, go for it. I mean, you know, you get to my stage of life and you've got the privilege of looking back over the years. I, to be honest, you know, I'm really grateful. I think I kind of came through into church leadership at a very exciting time. There was something of a renewal in the UK in the 70s. Stuff was popping. And so quite a lot of us took big steps. And I think, to be honest, you know, there's a bit of a culture of playing it safe nowadays, and that, you know, we get into our comfort zones and you miss the adventure. I mean, you know, obviously stepping out of a salary at LWT was a bit painful, but God's taken care of us amazingly over the years. I think there is this culture of playing it safe. Don't take too many chances. Watch for your pension and all that stuff. But no. If you get a spark, a sense of what if, to go for it. Because my experience, the Caleb moments, go for it. God's good. Yeah.
Yeah. You see, one of my favourite biblical characters is Jonah.
Oh.
I can identify with him. You know, when he's sitting underneath the tree at the end, he's like, come on, God, do something. And he's like all really angry and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So let's see the other side of it, because it does sound great that you can just go for it, but there must be times when you're feeling just like Jonah. So what can you remember those times?
Yeah, I mean, there were. Fortunately, they sort of dim with time. I mean, I do remember. I remember driving up here, you know, that with a young family in the back of the car, and it was actually a foggy day, and we're driving into this fog. And I remember thinking to myself, Lord, that's what it feels like. I'm driving into a fog. I don't know what lies ahead here. I was, say, commuting to London. I better tell you this one. So I was commuting to London. I ended up sort of, to make it all work, I was looking after a studio there. So I had to wait till after the late news or whatever. And I'd get the last train to Norwich. And I remember actually one time, it was in the winter, and Angie couldn't pick me up. It's sort of 1 a.m, young kids in bed. So I'm on my bike, pedaling down the road from the station in the pouring rain. And I got home. I said to my wife, we'll give it till the summer. And if it's still like this, we're out of here. Of course, we have moments like that. But I don't know, God came through. And and having good friends around you, you can be honest with them. I mean, that's why I love Job. You know, he wasn't afraid to have those robust conversations with God. God, this isn't fair. It's lament. And I think we forget what lament is. It's important. You know, any good relationship is going to have tough conversations. And I think, you know, I've developed that over the years, not afraid, well, especially, of course, when our daughter died and so on, to have those robust conversations. Lord, this is horrible. What? Why? Ouch. What are you doing? It's okay to have those conversations. And I think they're important. Sometimes we can feel it's not polite to be like that with God. No, it's correct. And Job kind of leads the way in that.
Yeah. You mentioned your daughter. I mentioned about Ali at the front end to this podcast.
Mm.
I think if we just talk about the book, then no one's going to buy it. So Hope Wins by Gough Hope. Please go and read it. But just give us a snippet, if that's all right, of what it must have been like for you to have lost your daughter. And of course, you know, you were coming through the fact that you had cancer as well, cancer of the prostate. So what do you remember of those times?
Well, yeah, pretty huge. Obviously, my surname, Hope.
Yeah.
It's a theme that it's kind of been with me and alive with me. And so, yeah, I was diagnosed with advanced prostate cancer when I was in my mid-50s. It was a shock. And that's the first thing I remember, the shock. I remember driving back from the surgeon said to me, or that's the consultant, you probably know already you've got prostate cancer. And no, I didn't know. I hadn't a clue. And you hear that dreaded word, the C word.
Yeah.
And we drove home in silence. I didn't know what to say. And so that it's the shock. And then the next thing is, if you're not careful, all the what if questions, you know. Unfortunately, I just picked up a little book in a secondhand bookshop by Henri Nouwen, and it's called In the Presence of the Lord. And it was really the kindness of God, because in that little book, he just says this: every day you've got a choice. You can either live in the house of fear, which is what the world is. It's full of fears. Or you can live in the house of the Lord. Which one do you want to live in? And that was kind of helpful. Okay, so when you wake up in the morning, instead of going straight down the tubes, I'd come up here to my loft and I'd just put music on and I would just have a few moments. Lord, I want to set my compass here. I might have a moan. I will have a moan, but I don't want to live in the house of fear. So that was the first thing for me. And I was in my mid-50s. I remember a friend praying over me, and he said, he was praying, Lord, we want this guy to be here when he's 70. And I remember thinking, fat chance of that. I mean, I wasn't a big, a mighty man of faith. I'm thinking, advanced prostate cancer? Well, I'm 70 now. So by the grace of God, I'm still here. I take medication, and I have to have operations every, you know, pretty often. But
yeah,
the tough thing perhaps now is that then our daughter, Ali, who with her young family, lovely Christian family. That was hard. They were camping down in Devon one August bank holiday. And so they're camping. So they're all kind of healthy. We got a call Saturday night from Dan. Ali's didn't feel well, went to the docs this morning. They've taken him in the hospital. We think it could be serious. And 2 weeks almost to the day later, she died. I mean, it was brutal. 2 weeks. You know, no time to write letters for your children. No time to do it. That was hard. Lord, this is. I'm ready. Lord, I'm ready. Why her? She's got a young family and a husband. That was hard, and that drove me to. It brought me to the book. Hope wins. There is a hope that can galvanize our lives. You know, as Christians, you know, in all honesty, I'm sure you've heard people, you know, when you're reading the Bible, they talk about faith, hope, and love.
Yes.
You know, these cardinal attributes or whatever. Faith, yeah, we know all about that. Put your trust in the Lord. Love, we understand that. God's love for us, which spills over into our love for others. But hope, I think we're pretty naff. We're not very good at it. We don't understand it. We think it's a specialist subject.
Yes.
And it really isn't. And, you know, it's become a complex thing, and it isn't. And I want to help people going through tough times, living in a culture where there isn't a lot of hope around. As Christians, there's this astonishing hope that we have for the future that I want to help people embrace in simple terms that will galvanize their lives, whatever they're going through. So, yeah, it was our daughter's very untimely death that led to that, the process of doing a Job. Oh, God, what on earth is happening here? And somehow coming through the other side, as Job did. But, God, I know that you're amazing, and one day I'm going to understand. You're going to make all things good and new one day. So that's the journey that I've been on these last few years.
How often did you blame God throughout this?
Oh, quite a bit. Yeah, I mean, and I still do at times, you know, when, you know, still now, three, four years later, you have a moment, your jolly phone throws up pictures every now and again, doesn't it, that you might want to remember. No, I don't want to see that. And it just, you know, Lord, why? That was so hard. But it's in the context of friendship. You know, it's my relationship with God is all the stronger because I have those robust conversations with him, but with that sense of hope, knowing that he is in control. And one day, all things new, wrongs righted. And I believe that with all my heart.
Just to go a bit further and a bit deeper, if that's all right. And then we're going to go off on a completely different tack, okay, Goff. Mm. But the fact that you survived the C word, but your daughter didn't.
Yeah.
How do you cope with that?
Yeah, that is tough. And I think, if I dare say this, sometimes in Christian circles, we're a bit triumphalistic about it all, you know. Now, don't get me wrong. I believe the Lord does beautiful things, helps, heals, all those beautiful things. Yes, I really do. But I noticed a while ago, I was reading through the book of Acts, and I can't remember the chapter. I ought to better remember it. It says there, you know, they're in Jerusalem, and the persecutions come along. And in one verse, it says, and James had his head cut off. And then in almost the next verse, it says that Peter's in prison and he gets a miracle and he's busted out of prison and he's knocking on the door when they're having a prayer meeting. You know the story. And it's they're all within two, three verses. And there's no comment. No one says, oh, well, that was a bit rough. And why? But I don't know. But such is the sovereignty of God. But here's the thing. I don't fully understand this, but through these processes, through this stuff we go through, somehow God is doing something in us that will ultimately reflect the glory of God. And I in my book, I use the illustration of a diamond. And now I don't know much about cutting of stones and that, but the more cuts that you get on a diamond, the more it just reflects the light in a more complex and beautiful way. I don't understand this. Somehow that's what is going on in our lives, in this short part of our lives, while we're on the planet as it is. And one day I will see my daughter again and she'll just be sparkling.
Yeah.
Do you know what? We won't be compensated. It's not that we're compensated. It's all kind of glorified. There's a sparkle in it all. So somehow, I don't get this. In the Bible, I think we find that suffering and glory go together. I mean, that's what happened to Jesus, didn't it? And yes, let's pray for the sick and we want to be well. Oh, yes. But also, there's an amazing story. I mean, Johnny Erickson would be a classic example. People whose lives just shine amazingly somehow through the grace of God working in their painful lives.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I don't understand it all. But somehow God does work all things for the good of those who love him. One day, all things new. I believe, you know, Christians have said that in creeds for thousands of years, you know, about the future. And yet I'm not sure we always really believe it and embrace it anymore. Future hope matters a lot. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, it certainly has gone a long way to answering it, if that's okay. And I think the best thing to say is, for those that want to know more, like what you shared, the book Hope Wins, How a Vision of Our Eternal Future Impacts Our Lives Today, by Goth Hope, is available at good bookshops. And yes, you only have to see the number of people at the back who've endorsed it. Talking to the book, actually, Goth, how cathartic was it for you to sit down and say, right, I'm going to do it? And why did you want to write the book in the first place?
It was cathartic. It was. I suppose because of this growing sense, I want Christians today to get a good grasp of their future. More than ever, we're living in a culture. I mean, I grew up in the 60s, and so, you know, you could expect a great future, career, like, you know, it was fun. It's not like that now. It's a fearful world. And I think it's time for us Jesus followers to be a bit different to our neighbours in terms of what's going on in the world, because we've got a magnificent hope. And I want to articulate that in simple terms so that people can really, live out the good of it that it brings into our lives. You know, there is a future, a wonderful future, really, all things new. It's part of biblical Christianity. Let's wave the flag. Let's be clear and not complicated and help people embrace the future that is theirs as Christians and help, hopefully, make a difference in the neighbourhood.
But you said that word, so I'm going to pick on it. So why do we make it complicated then?
You know, spot on. I was reading recently in reading Thessalonians. Now, you may know, Paul spent about 2 weeks in Thessalonica. 2 weeks. So the guys are very, and it was a lot of Gentiles there, not Jewish church. They barely got through the Alpha course, okay? he has to leave town because there's a bit of a riot. But he writes to them, and he writes Thessalonians. And what does he write? He writes about their future hope. This is new Christians, and he's saying, oh, look, I want you to know this hope, I'm using colloquial language, this hope will strengthen you through the persecution you're facing. And I want you to know that, one of these days, that Jesus will appear in majesty and glory. I don't know what that looks like. He is coming again to make all things new, to right wrongs, to deal with all the injustices. He is. And the beautiful thing about, you know, just the beauty of a new creation, the lamb lying down with the wolf and so on. And as he's writing this to Christians, are 2 weeks old. And you've got me on my hobby horse now.
No, it's great. Keep going.
Why do we use all this jargon? For instance, the word rapture, it's not even a Bible word. It's not even a Greek word. It's a Latin word that someone popped up and thought, oh, we'll use this. Do you know what? In the Greek, it's the same word as when it says about no one will pluck you out of my hand. It's that word, pluck you out. That's the word, plucking you out. We make it a complicated word. The same with parousia. Theologians love all that, the coming. It just means coming. And so the same word, when we came to you in Thessalonica, well, why not use the same word in the English language? We put these complicated words around it and make it something that it really, really was never should have been. And so people back off and they're always complicated, it's controversial. No, it's not. It's not. And we don't have to know all the exact details, but we need to know the main plot. And that is hugely important. And if you look at Thessalonians, Paul is telling these young Christians, giving them the future to help them through the present, the persecutions that they're going through. So please, why? Maybe there'll be another book, The Future Made Simple for the Christian, because it really should be always as was intended to be, and we've made it a controversy for experts and taken it away from the layman. Tragic, especially when hope is in such sorts of life.
Yes, and a few weeks ago, we released a special podcast with Jeannie Kendall, and we were looking at what Paul really thought of women. And from Jeannie's point of view, she was saying, misunderstood, and she wanted to champion him. And we had a subtitle, which was Context is Everything. I'm just wondering, from your point of view, having been to Bible college as well and everything else like that, how often do we take so many things out of context and therefore miss what the actual Bible is saying?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. We can read it with a religious mindset, which is why, you know, I said to you earlier, I just started looking at The Chosen.
Yeah.
My son said, yeah, you've got to look at this. Whoa, yeah, Peter, he was like that, this sort of earthy guy. So you're right. We do need to keep that earthy context radical. We don't, you know, let's not sanitize it. Let's keep this, the real message of the Bible for ordinary people. I mean, Jesus eating with publicans and sinners and so on, you know. Well, come on, this is radical. And we need to make sure that we read the Bible properly. I mean, this is where I love Eugene Peterson, you know, bless him. He's gone to be with the Lord now, hasn't he? Mm-hmm. But I just love his earthy approach in his books and in, of course, The Message. He does it well. I like him for that. Of course, he was a pastor. I like him for that.
Moving on then. I did mention your bread-making skills, so maybe you could tie this into why did you go to China? Tell me more, please.
New Frontiers, we have these sort of days of prayer and together, prayer and fasting together and so on. And I was approached by the team, would I think of going? There were some opportunities there. And so we checked this out. I don't know, it sounds crazy, doesn't it? But we went out, Angie and I. We had no idea how long we'd been there, what it would be like, how it would work. Oh, do you know, it was an absolute privilege. It was just before the Olympics, so the door was fairly open to go in and out. And we were part of the international church there in Beijing. And it was, oh my word, you know, what a privilege speaking the English language, the English speaking congregation. I don't know, 1,500 people or more, every nationality in the world, except local Chinese, of course. And you're speaking to all these nations. And then we started a little congregation down near Red Square, near Tiananmen Square. I mean, heady days. But in the middle of all that, it was the friendships, the connections. And I met a dear guy he and his wife were leading an orphanage on the edge of Beijing. Because, of course, one-child policy, if children were deformed or you wanted a son and it was a girl, they were abandoned. And this lovely orphanage, my friend ran. It was so special, so very, very special. So, we went. Why? Because New Frontiers, let's be on the front foot. Where might God give us an opportunity to go? So we were there. We weren't there that long. Different things happened. We then came back to the UK. But some friendships forged that have continued, and it certainly opened my eyes, you know, really. I remember being in a house church meeting one Sunday morning, and this person came up to me and says, would you preach long sermon? We like long sermon. No one has ever said that to me before.
Certainly not me.
You know, when I'd refer to a scripture verse, there'd be a rustling of paper. Everyone would go there and they'd all read it. And such a lovely, I don't know, hunger. It made me realize how in our culture here, we do feel quite, I don't know, we feel pressured to keep a bit quiet.
Yeah.
And a bit ashamed, really, of our faith. Whereas in China, where they might have very good reason to feel a bit cautious, there's just this lovely joy and pride in knowing the Lord. And that kind of challenged me to realizing the kind of culture that we are trying to live in as Christians here.
So having been to China, and you still got your connections there, and I do hear occasionally some amazing stories of what's going on over in China.
Mm.
The underground church is becoming slightly more open and everything else like that. Coming back to the UK, though, in light of what you were saying about the 60s, you know, when even the media were talking about Billy Graham.
Yeah.
What do you think currently of the UK as far as Christianity is concerned?
Wow, good question. Well, I'm encouraged. You know, there are some lovely stories that I think some of the nations that are coming into our nation, many are bringing a fresh sense of the Christian faith, you know, some of the churches in London and so on. But I'm encouraged. I love the whole Alpha thing. But more than ever, we need to be on the front foot. We need to be making a difference. You know, let's not just be passive, looking on sort of, isn't it bad? But let's be active. Let's be demonstrating the difference that it means to be Christians. I think it's a great opportunity, you know, the area of hope as well as anything else, in days of fear and uncertainty. What an opportunity to be showing, living, demonstrating something different that hopefully our friends and neighbours will say, what have you got? What's going on there? How come you're not, you know, thrown by all this stuff that's going on around the nations? Yeah, so I think it's a time of opportunity. Let's not just look on and, oh, how bad it is. Let's try and demonstrate the difference that it can make knowing the Lord Jesus.
Okay, but from the media point of view, of which you were part of it, and okay, we only had three channels in the 60s and in the 70s, I get the feeling now that the media is more controlling than ever with regard to, let's say, belittling the Christian faith because they wouldn't do it to any other faith. I don't know, I could be wrong. What do you think? If that's the case, what do we do about it?
Yeah, you are right. I think we do need champions who will forge a path, will speak well. I'm now 70, coming up 71. I've fought certain battles. Mm-hmm. The next tranche of Christian church leaders will need to fight different battles. And, one of them, of course, is being really articulate in the way you say things, how you say things. They'll need all the prayer and encouragement they can get because it will be challenging. They're different battles to the ones that I fought, and I do feel for them. And so we need to be praying for those champions in the media and so on, encouraging them to keep going for it. People like yourself and many, many others, because it is vital. And we want to see people emerging there who people are going to speak well of. I mean, am I allowed to mention some names here?
Go for it, please.
Dan Walker, what a guy. I saw him, he was on one sort of travel program he was on a while back. But the person who was with him was, they were looking at a sort of church building or something. And it just in a very ordinary way talked about faith. And this person said to him, I've no respect you, Dan. You never speak badly of people. Is that to do with your faith? And I took that little sentence, I thought, whoa, that speaks volumes. And just in gentle ways, he's not afraid to make people aware that he's a Christian, but he's a very, very approachable and good-hearted guy. Yeah, you need to pray for people like that a lot.
When you were in the media back in the 60s and 70s then, and obviously they knew you were a Christian, how belittled were you by people working around you?
Well, a bit, of course. It's always going to be challenging for our faith, but it's different now. There's a hostility in the air now that you've got to really be careful to navigate well.
What do you mean by hostility in the air?
Okay, we have to mind our P's and Q's a bit because there's, think of social media again. People will pick up on a phrase or a word. And if you've not sort of got it quite right or it could be misunderstood, you're going to be digging yourself out of a hole. So you have got to be very alert. I mean, I think even back in my day, some people would respect you for your faith. And that does still happen here and there. So I think it's the nature of faith. It will always, to some extent, be challenging to nail your colours to the mast. It's working out how to do that in the most appropriate way that won't alienate you, but will hopefully help people understand that you're human, mm-hmm. you're real, and what you've got is special, is important. So it's the good and the bad. But to get the good, you might sometimes have to put up with the, you idiot, what on earth do you think you believe?
Bread making. Let's link it in, please, with hospitality and your thoughts on that.
Bread. What a smell. When it's baking, when it's fresh, what a irresistible, wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And of course, for me as a Christian, Jesus, the bread of life, there should be something attractive and beautiful about that. So yeah, bread, I love fresh bread. And so, over the years, I've done quite a lot of that and playing around and mainly from a packet, okay?
We'll have to have a chat afterwards because I make my own bread. I'll tell you about that.
It is special, really special. And honestly, one of my favourite pastimes is sitting around table with friends, having meals together. I love it. It doesn't matter what the food's on the table, really. Just being around table, having people in our home. In fact, when you look in Timothy in the Bible, Timothy and Titus in the Bible, one of the qualifications of a leader is hospitality. And you can see why. Just the beauty of opening your home, your life, having people around your table. I love it. And all we sometimes do pancake breakfast on a Saturday where the folks got young children so they can come along as well. We love doing that. And it's Oh, it's the glue. It's in church family life. It's special. Yeah, it's a favourite pastime doing that, sitting around table.
But haven't you noticed, because we were talking about being yourself and everything else and that, have you not noticed that if you sit round the table with somebody and they're not a Christian, that there will be that time where, because they're trusting you, because they're in an environment that they feel safe in, eventually that question is going to come up, and it won't be a derogatory question. They might word it as if it sounds derogatory, but they actually want to know about why you became a Christian. So why can't we do that more often?
You're absolutely right. These are priorities we don't always see. And, we get very busy as leaders and this and that. It's a tragedy because this is fundamental. Sitting around table, your guard comes down. You're sitting around table having table fellowship. Hey, I mean, after all, that's what breaking bread is, communion, isn't it? We should be coming around table. That's how it began, around the table. Jesus took the bread, the wine. It's beautiful. This is, you're singing my tune. I think it's a lovely thing to be round table with dear friends. Yeah, you've got to have a big dining table so you can just get everyone around it and have the food doesn't matter. We don't want to be posh necessarily. It really, the main thing is being friends and sitting around table together. Beautiful.
Yeah. And in fact, you only need four ingredients in which to make bread. What is great is that if you don't want to use your oven, they make flatbreads. I mean, it is so easy. Back to how they would have done it 2,000 years ago. You can fill it with so many bits and bobs of food. Yeah. Make some bread and invite some friends around. They don't have to go to church even. Just sit down and see what happens. And the idea of just tearing the bread with a nice hunk of cheese and maybe a glass of wine or some beer, but that's another story altogether. So now I know what you're going to be doing short term. You're going to be making bread this weekend, inviting people around. But medium term, long term, what can we see from young Goth, please?
Well, I was speaking to someone about this morning. I think at this stage, I want to go on being a part of the church family here. We've given half our lives to. I love it. It's part of us, part of our lives. But also, I want to input and encourage younger leaders who are finding their way, encourage them, pass on something of what I do. And I've got the privilege of doing that within New Frontiers, hopefully passing on something, encouraging younger leaders on their journey.
I did say right at the beginning that we had technical issues. And when you were sharing about your daughter, Ali, yourself having cancer, this has never happened before, but twice I had these like bubbles turn up on the screen, which I think can be done through pushing a button or whatever. And all of a sudden it was like the thumb up and like good. Never had that before. Even my laptop must have thought you were quite good at what you were sharing, which is brilliant. Goff, I know you've got other things to do, so let's go for the end if that's right now, please, sir. And let's discuss your Christian hero. It's great how we can learn. Me personally, that's how I've learnt, by reading biographies and autobiographies outside of the Bible. Who, Goff Hope, is your Christian hero?
Oh, this is so tough. I'm going to go for a pretty well-known one who has probably been chosen before, and that would be Martin Luther King Jr.
He has been chosen before. He's one of my heroes. I don't think enough is said about Martin Luther King. So you have 2 minutes, please, to tell us more about why he's your hero and a bit of history about him, please.
Okay, well, of course, he's famous for his speech, the famous speech, and, I have a dream, and with my passion for hope and future hope, that kind of resonates. Before that speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, I want to go back to 1955. He was just 26 years old, fresh out of college, and became pastor of a small black church in Montgomery, Alabama. And a year later, there was an incident in town that was probably the first step in the journey that would take him to Washington and his speech and cost him his life. A black lady got on a bus, and you may know this, sat on a seat which was for whites only. And when the driver asked her to move to the back of the bus, she refused and was arrested. She wasn't an activist. She was a humble seamstress. And it caused an outcry in the black community. It led to the bus boycott. And they looked for someone to champion their cause. And they chose this young pastor. He was barely out of college. And a few months later, his house was bombed. He wasn't there, but his wife and baby daughter were inside. And there was a crowd outside his bombed house, ready to do battle. And in that tense moment, with tempers running high, this young 26-year-old guy, he said this: "Don't get your weapons. He who lives by the sword is going to perish by the sword. We want to love our enemies. I want you to love our enemies. Be good to them. Love them and let them know that you love them. If I'm stopped, our world will stop. what we're doing is right. And that was the beginning of the journey that took him to Washington. But here's the thing. Martin Luther King, he insisted that the Christian church, and I love this phrase, it shouldn't be merely a thermometer that records and comments on what's going on in society. Ooh, isn't it awful, awful? Not a thermometer, but a thermostat that has an effect and that brings the warmth of the gospel, of God's love, into society to transform it. I love that analogy. A thermostat making a difference, turning up the warmth rather than a thermometer, just reading what's going on and being commentators and pessimists and so on. Just 8 years later, after that bombing of his house and a couple of imprisonments, he was addressing 250,000 people at the Lincoln Memorial and delivered his speech. What you may not know about that speech is that there's quite a long introduction, which is a bit kind of rambly. And apparently, someone behind him whispered to him, "Martin, tell him about the dream."
That's right, yeah.
And he went off script, and I love it. And it's so eloquent. And, you know, I have a dream. One day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. And then that other lovely line, and this is beautiful. "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today," and, you know, "so let freedom ring." Bless him, you know. And 5 years later, he was assassinated. But he understood the importance of holding on to the fundamentals of the Christian faith, loving one another, holding on to that magnificent future hope that we have as Christians. And that fueled him. It fueled his mission, his dream, his vision of the world, and it led to huge change in the nation. So bless him. You know, that he inspires me. You can only live that kind of life when you have, in his words, an infinite hope, a hope that goes beyond the present. And that's the gospel, the Christian hope that goes beyond the grave. Yeah, I chose him as my hero.
Can I just say, top jolly banana choice. Fantastic. I'm trying to remember now two things. First of all, the person who actually whispered behind in terms of the dream, because he had told that speech before, hadn't he? And the person who told was somebody really well known. I can't remember who it was.
It was a singer, a woman singer.
It was. It was either Mahalia Jackson.
It was.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was Mahalia Jackson. Thank you. That was the first thing. And the second thing, I mentioned earlier on about Jeannie Kendall. Her choice of Christian hero was the lady sitting at the bus. And so if you want to know more about her, then go to the original Jeannie Kendall episode, not the two special did subsequently, and she will share more about what happened to the lady afterwards.
Lovely.
Yeah, in Montgomery, Alabama. Yeah.
Lovely.
Gough, it's been brilliant. Thank you so much for spending time. Thank you also for your patience with regard to our technical issues.
You're welcome.
Gough Hope, thank you so much for joining us today. Cheers.
Thank you, Martin.
God bless.
Bye now.